This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. I'm excited to tell you about today's show, but before I do that, please take a moment to subscribe to this podcast at reason.com/podcasts at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Reason's other programs, too. There's The Reason Roundtable, a rollicking weekly show featuring me, Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Matt Welch, hashing out the issues of the day. And there's also the Soho Forum Debates, a recording of the monthly debate series we sponsor in New York City. And now on to The Reason Interview. In 1964, President Lyndon Johnson announced his plans for what he called the Great Society, a sweeping set of programs that marked the most ambitious and far-reaching expansion of the federal government since Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Johnson declared war on poverty, jacked up federal spending on and control over education. He pushed massive new entitlements, including Medicare and Medicaid, which promised to deliver high-quality and low-cost health care to the nation's elderly and poor, mostly at taxpayer expense. When Republican Richard Nixon succeeded Democrat LBJ as president after the 1968 election, he continued and expanded many of the Great Society programs, despite being from a different political party. But did the Great Society achieve its goals of eradicating poverty, sheltering the homeless, and helping all citizens participate more fully in the American dream? In A New History of the Great Society, Amity Schles argues that Lyndon Johnson's bold makeover of the government was a massive failure, despite the good intentions of its architect and implementers. Schles, who is the author of a best-selling history of the Great Depression and the chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, says remembering the failure of the Great Society is especially relevant in an election year when presidential candidates are promising to spend huge amounts of money on all sorts of new government programs. I sat down to talk with her about the origins of the Great Society, its failure, and what it all means for 21st century America. Amity Schles, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick.
So let's start. What was the Great Society?
Lyndon Johnson became president, and the adjective for Lyndon Johnson is ambitious. So he wanted to do something that would make him look great, greater than perhaps President Kennedy, who preceded him and died tragically, greater than his successors, so good wouldn't do. And he and his aides put together a program they called Great Society. The impulses, though, came from sources beyond Johnson, behind him, around him, which were the impulses of American society. They, young Americans, as today, wanted to do something really grand. They didn't even merely constrain their goals to going to the moon, as President Kennedy had suggested. They wanted to change the society, transform it, clean up any errors, and make us go from good to great. So you have national ambition, personal presidential ambition. And the third group I'd add are professors, experts, who felt that through new knowledge, through the knowledge of technology, the government could get to great in a way it had not been able to before. We could get to the moon of domestic policy as well as the moon in the sky.
So LBJ in the mid-60s, or shortly after winning re-election, he gave a speech where he unveils the Great Society, and he says, "We will build a great society. It is a society where no child will go unfed and no youngster will go unschooled." What were the major constituent programs? Because in the end, this was, you know, really about the federal government doing a lot more than it had ever really thought to do.
You want to think about Johnson. This is actually 1964. So he's become president, but he must run for office. And he has three C's: classroom, cities, countryside. In a beautiful speech he gave at the University of Michigan. No accident, it was at the University of Michigan, student center, center of auto land, the university of the elite of Motor City, and the center of America, the heartland. And he declared these goals. In addition, of course, as part of his Great Society, Johnson promised to cure poverty. He didn't say, "I will provide a useful palliative." He said, "I will cure poverty. And to be fair, if you look at the country at the time, everyone thought maybe poverty could be cured. Everyone thought poverty could be cured. Norman Podhoretz, the great writer, said later, we thought this stuff was just the mopping up action, not a big deal. If you can win Europe, you can certainly win poverty.
So what went into the poverty alleviation programs that were part of the Great Society?
Well, no one exactly knew. Johnson is, all presidents are just a collection of impulses. One of his impulses, those of Johnson, was to complete the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt from the 1930s. So Roosevelt went X, Johnson wants to go 2X and deliver to the rest of the poor people. Roosevelt didn't get to. That was the first reason for the poverty emphasis. Another reason.
And he talked about that. You were mentioning cities and countryside. So it's both poor people in urban areas and in places like Detroit, near University of Michigan, as well as the countryside, Appalachia, kind of hill country Texas.
Hill country Texas. And nothing is new. It is just forgotten. As in the epigram, they had their own hillbilly elegy. Mm-hmm. That was a book called The Other America, which focused on poverty in Appalachia. Same thing, intractable, difficult, a shame, a humiliation involving hunger, although it's not clear everyone's starving. Mm-hmm. Some may be hungry some days, certainly malnutrition. That became an emphasis. So there that was. You have those, that set of impulses. And in addition, you had the idea that a federal office can do this, and John and the delivery is as important as the goal. Johnson didn't really think too hard about what he was doing. He just thought, we're going to deal with poverty. He created a poverty czar. That was Sergeant Shriver, the brother-in-law of late President Kennedy, the man who led the Peace Corps, a man with all the goodwill in the world, a very good-looking man. So he was sort of like Superman, Sarge Shriver, to be the poverty czar at the poverty office, which was called the Office of Economic Opportunity. And Johnson thought, this is great, but it didn't turn out as they imagined.
Other big programs included things like Medicare and Medicaid. How did they sell Medicare?
Well, you want to think, it was said of Johnson by Joe Califano, who's a wonderful writer, that he made laws the way other people ate chocolate chip cookies. Mm. This is his strength. We've studied this, Robert Caro. So he said, well, we'll complete the healthcare program that Truman so loved and was not able to get through Congress. Maybe we'll do more for poor people, not just old people. And, you know, these things are expensive, but we'll just append them to Social Security. They can't be that expensive. Remember, at the time, life expectancy was not where it is today. Johnson himself did not live to his 80s. So these men thought, well, for a few years, old people can be taken care of. Nothing's wrong with that. It's a sort of story of unintended consequences. And these little programs, sort of little, were appended to Social Security as amendments, Medicare and Medicaid. And there was no idea, this is a story of unintended consequences, that those programs would become so giant and effectively begin to dwarf Social Security itself. So though they were there, there was National Public Radio. There was the what we call the long march through the institutions by the left. We created a lot of institutions and allowed progressives and left-leaners to begin to run them. So there were institutions, that particularly public media, that didn't seem, I mean, Sesame Street, well, how can you disagree with that? That didn't seem set to change or take over our culture, but really did come to shape the culture in ways that, to an extent today, seem regrettable. In addition, I would add something I never would have thought of, which is they had the little legal aid office at the Office of Economic Opportunity with the poverty czar. That sounds nice. What's wrong with that? A lady gets beaten up. She wants to get divorced. She has no money. She's a Mexican-American. She may not even have citizenship. She gets a lawyer funded by the federal government. That legal aid office, which wasn't particularly large at the beginning, very quickly became an office to change America through litigation rather than through legislation. So all of a sudden, for example, this office from Washington would be funding an office in California, California Rural Legal Assistance, to sue the governor of California, same thing in other states, or to sue mainly in class actions. And this was not quite, I don't imagine, what Lyndon Johnson or maybe even Sergeant Shriver had really thought through. It was a dynamic that grew on its own. Let's litigate ourselves to utopia.
I guess it's hard now to look back at people like LBJ and JFK or Sergeant Shriver, to the extent that people remember him, as people who had lived through the Depression, because we think of the 60s as something that came after World War II, that came after the Depression. But these were people who were fully formed by the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. Is it right to say that the Great Society, we think of it in a kind of like 60s and hippies context, but it's the final act of the New Deal and a kind of Roosevelt vision of government?
It's the final act of the New Deal, and even farther than Roosevelt, at least farther than Roosevelt on most days. So Roosevelt kind of thought he wanted to have freedom from fear, freedom from want. Mm-hmm. You think of the Norman Rockwell pictures.
The four freedoms.
And one of them was freedom from want. Well, that's a tall order. That's a positive right. But Roosevelt never got it all through. He was also spewing domestic material, even as he devoted 35% of our economy to World War II, wartime talk, wartime show off in a way, in order to unite the country and get it through. But what's very interesting here is that when we're thinking about the 60s and the 30s, in the 30s, we actually had a genuine crisis. One in four men unemployed in the early 30s, hence the New Deal. In the 60s, we didn't have a crisis.
Right.
We just had idealism.
Right.
And so let's finish that other thing, and everyone who's at least a bit sad will be fixed up. And we had genuine problems. The only question was how to fix them, how to get to great. There were actually two options. Do you get to great? You want to be great. Do you get to great through the public sector or the private sector? Is the public sector the only way? Could the private sector conceivably ever mail letters or mass communication, send
Obviously
messages?
Not.
Never. No, the private sector could never do that.
We need taxi cabs, commissioned by cities and all that.
But at the very least, we need guilds,
right?
The taxi guild. And so we went for the public sector over and over again in the 1960s with the idea, you can use various metaphors, Nick, but with the idea that the private sector was the milk cow, the domestic animal, as Keynes saw, that provided the money, the wherewithal for the public sector experiments. And the private sector was just sort of to the side and to be taken for granted. That's what someone especially like Johnson or Sarge Shriver would think. Well, America will always grow, all things being equal.
They didn't really have a clear understanding of private sector or of a kind of capitalist creative destruction model. They just took wealth production for granted.
Right. And frankly, it's easy for us to talk about creative destruction because we've seen eBay destroy some kinds of retail. We've seen Amazon destroy other kinds of retail brutally, but arguably interestingly, and maybe for the better. So they hadn't quite seen that. These people grew up in the Depression, served in the military, and operated in the military-industrial complex. So in the beginning of the book, I described the employees of Fairchild, the camera parts company that also made microchips, wondering if they would ever have a contract that was not a government contract. Well, that might not be possible. We're part of the military. The entire state of California was dependent on the military. They said that lawmakers would get up on their hinds like donkeys and bray when defense contracts were taken away from their states, because how could California ever thrive without being all defense? That was the idea. And it was a gradual illumination in the 60s. Oh, yeah, we can make these little chips and we can put them in things people want at home. And not just refrigerators, by the way. And there's a wonderful kind of enlightenment at Fairchild, which, of course, became Intel. Oh, wow, we can get contracts from people. We can make things that help the economy grow without the government. Everyone at that time, say the men were grown up, maybe they'd gone to school in 1948. That's late enough that they would have learned about planning in economics, God and man at Yale, not individual enterprise, which they might have learned in 1925. And they all thought, well, planning and the military-industrial complex are necessary to sustain the supremacy of the United States in the bitter Cold War.
Right. And this is, they're living in a world where everything was big after, the collapse of small-scale capitalism or the laissez-faire illusion had been unmasked at the end of the 20s. And you either had big governments like the United States and certainly the Soviet Union or big companies like AT&T and IBM and Xerox that were too big to fail.
Too big to fail. And remember, this was also the time for business friends of Peter Drucker, who saw through it. If you want to look for an intellect, the commentator, business consultant and commentator. But it was also the era when we believed in the conglomerate and the diversified conglomerate just for the sake of business and capital, really. We need money to slosh around in our company. So there were companies such as ITT, which became absurd because they had so many unrelated subsidiaries. So imagine bigness for the sake of itself at this time and this sudden epiphany that maybe small might be better. And what's interesting is watching Ronald Reagan take this in a Californian, because I'm sure at the beginning he didn't really envision Silicon Valley, right. Reagan, but he did say, wow, I like this idea of a creative society that grows.
We'll get to him because he's one of the characters who is, he kind of, I'll spoil the ending, he's kind of revealed as a major figure in all of this towards the end of the book. But let's talk about several of the figures and themes that you come back to again and again and kind of how they amplify the themes in your analysis. You mentioned a bit guns and butter. This is something I remember in the early first half of the 80s taking economics classes. We would hear a lot about the guns and butter curve or a trade-off between guns and butter. You actually, in the beginning of each chapter, you put the amount of the federal budget that is devoted to defense, guns versus butter, entitlements. What is guns and butter and why is it so important?
But guns and butter were two terms we used for defense and entitlements. And the idea, as now, is that guns cost so much more than everything else. That's a myth. It was even beginning to be a myth then. So what was interesting was everyone thought, we can't afford the Great Society because of the guns. We have to have the Great Society because of the guns, because we need consolation, distraction, and progress at home with this war not progressing so well abroad. But very quickly, in fact, within the time frame of the book, 1971, we're suddenly spending more on butter than guns. So this idea that all was the butter made it impossible.
The
butter
was the federal government.
This is so federal, not
the one thing we know. Yeah, the one thing we know is like guns, national defense is a constitutional prerequisite, whatever, of the federal government. It needs to supply that. By 1971, the federal government was spending more on butter than on guns.
That's right. And that's a big change for the United States. If you look at the defense spending today relative to the Korean War, say World War II and Vietnam, it's very small as a share of GDP. Of course, this is an important chart that everyone must look at because when you look at it, you will see that if the whole budget, you'll see, of course, entitlements are so much more than guns. Don't let anyone mislead you with confining terms.
Right.
Always look at the whole chart.
So although we do spend a lot of money on guns still, but as a share of the federal budget and a share
it's smaller.
Of the, yes.
And so they were just beginning to see this. And a few characters see it early. One is Arthur Burns, and we'll come, I think we'll come back to him. Another is Charles de Gaulle, who's been there, done that with Vietnam, is noticing that at home the U.S. is spending quite a bit, maybe more than the U.S. can afford, and likes shorting the dollar, essentially. And he was one of the European leaders who put pressure on our currency by withdrawing gold from the United States, which in those days governments could do. We were under the so-called gold exchange standard. That Treasury didn't like that. Nobody likes their gold to be taken. And de Gaulle was the buoyant, chauvinistic Frenchman, but he also had the insight to see that social democracy had hurt France, and now it was beginning to hurt the United States, and certainly would in future through the commitments we made in the 60s. So you have all these outsiders, Milton Friedman too, saying, whoa, the terms of the economics we're operating on are going to go away and change, and this is not going to work in the future. Our commitments are too great.
Talk about Arthur Burns, because he's one of the major figures of the book. Who was he and why is he important?
Arthur Burns, one reason he's in the book is he was the paradigm of the guild economist. He was a wonderful numbers cruncher. He pioneered numbers crunching. It was said he could predict the business cycle by the strength of the tobacco in an auto dealership sales room. Much respected by peers.
He was a teacher of Milton Friedman.
Teacher
and later
of Milton
a kind
Friedman.
Of, or, you know, they came to disagreements over things.
Right. He probably considered himself the mentor of Milton Friedman. He introduced Milton Friedman when Milton Friedman gave a great speech right around then, 67, 68, 69. And he had written as a young man a monograph of which he was very proud called Prosperity Without Inflation, i.e. we don't need inflation. And in this story, he's like a character in a Greek tragedy, because he is the one who warns of inflation, the sings, the Cassandra, and he is complicit in causing the great 1970s inflation. And
he became the head of the Federal Reserve.
Oh, yes. The way that it worked was Nixon liked him. Nixon, and in this book, Nixon is scarcely different from Johnson, so that's certainly a revision. Nixon liked Burns. Burns had given Nixon a precious gift, which is this. Nixon had lost in 1960, and Burns, the wise economist, had given him an explanation for that defeat, which suggested the defeat was not Nixon's fault. That's very precious. The defeat happened because interest rates weren't low enough. It was the Fed's fault that the Republicans were not returned to power into the White House. Well, and vain people, all of us, love to know a big defeat of ours was not our fault. There was an affection. Nixon, and a very intelligent man, also prized Burns's intelligence. Burns had a pipe. He was pompous as he could be. It took him a long time to say what he said, but Nixon looked up to him, and Nixon made him Fed chairman. And Burns fully expected that Nixon would do everything that Burns, he, the senior person, the Fed god, wanted, and would leave him alone. Just as now we see President Trump and the Fed chairman at odds, then too there was such a case, because Nixon realized that if interest rates didn't stay low or come down, then he might not win re-election. Just as with President Trump, and indeed President Johnson, who badgered and bullied William McChesney Martin, his Fed chairman. So you're wondering, what would Burns do? Burns, the Cassandra about inflation, and Burns dramatically, theatrically, tragically failed and gave in because he wanted Nixon's love.
So he helped the Fed lower interest rates
rates lower than he otherwise might have. Let's just say that. He also goosed the money supply, because meanwhile talking in his ear was Milton Friedman. And also, you know, Milton Friedman began to take shots across the bow, public shots, saying Arthur should look at money, but maybe Arthur should be tighter with the money supply there over there at the Fed. And Nixon is very funny, because it's the Nixon of the impeachment and the Nixon of Watergate, a kind of adumbration of Watergate. Nixon, very bossy, sends his yes men, the Haldeman Ehrlichman type, to Mr. Burns and says, you know, the president made you Fed chairman, Arthur. He expects you to be loyal, Arthur. Arthur, we need lower interest rates. And Burns basically caves over time. And this is the story of working for a charismatic boss. This is the elixir, the OxyContin of being in the White House, right? You're so happy to be there, you certainly don't want to go. And there's a famous weekend when a number of economic steps were planned, committed to, at Camp David in the summer of 71, that would have been to a pre-Fed Burns anathema, and yet he signs on to them just for the joy of being an Olympian with the president at the president's retreat, being waited on hand and foot by military men or who knows what, Secret Service. Just the joy of being close again to Nixon. So it's a terrible failure for the economics profession that an economic leader would act so irresponsibly. And I do tell about it in chapter 12.
So talk about the TV show Bonanza, which I think is on like MeTV, or it's on like an old person's TV show now. A gigantic hit that spanned the 60s. Why is the TV show Bonanza in your book?
Well, the book is about economic growth, really, and can you get it through the public or the private sector? And one of our preoccupations at the very beginning of the 60s was, what do you do with the growth? How do you get it? It's less, well, maybe we'll take it for granted, but what do you do with it? And what's interesting about Bonanza is it was a Western, but it was a different kind of Western. It wasn't a cowboy coming into town, shooting a bad man and leaving with the girl. No more village, off to the next adventure. It was about cowboys The Cart writes that Ponderosa is so wealthy that they have responsibility to civilize Main Street, right? To teach men not to shoot, to, I don't know, to figure out what the price of a bull should be, to figure out what is gold, and mainly to figure out how to be leaders in their community. It's a very different kind of Western. We're going to figure out what to do with the wealth and how to help one another build a community. So this show, which was in color, by the way, that's just a new thing, became very popular. It was the sort of story of America. We're rich now, so what should we do with that? And in the beginning of the decade, it squeezed out some other shows. It was on Sunday prime time. That's prime territory. That's uber prime, right? What's interesting is when the presidents had to go on with their various addresses, maybe relating to Vietnam, or Nixon relating to his Camp David plan in the summer of 1971, they had to decide whether to preempt Bonanza. It was the best part of prime, Sunday night, and good to do because Europeans, markets open earlier if you do it Sunday night. Whatever you say, European markets have time to digest. But it's also risky because you risk offending Americans, and we Americans were addicted to Bonanza. So Nixon actually preempted Bonanza to make his announcement of his incongruous, awful, populist economic plan
and
of 1971.
Lower interest rates, wage and price controls, a bunch of tariffs and things like that.
A bunch of tariffs. Going off the gold standard was the main thing, which basically meant denying any accountability for inflation. If you want to translate that, gold was like the Bitcoin of the day. It said, here's something you can trade your paper for that's out. It checks the sovereign currency. When people bought gold, it's as when they buy Bitcoin today. It's because they don't trust the sovereign currency. And tariffs, taxes to help businesses here. And people like Arthur Burns or other economists, including George Shultz, for example, or the recently deceased Paul Volcker, once in a while, we try to stop Nixon and say, well, wait a minute, if we impose tariffs, we don't need to go off the gold standard, which will increase the value of foreign currencies and reduce their competitiveness. Those both go in the same direction, those measures. Why don't you pick one, Mr. President? No, Nixon did all. And by the way, it was the bully who led with him. And that's important, too, a kind of Johnsonian figure, big and scary, named John Connolly, whom Nixon was courting as this possible partner, fusion ticket to run in 1972. So all this romance and personality is going on with great economic consequence.
Who is Walter Reuther?
Walter Reuther was a name of many of our childhood. So if in the 60s you were hearing about the body count in Vietnam, the word, what is it, casualty? The 8-year-old is wondering, casualty, does that mean dead or just hurt? You know, think of hearing the news from the point of view of an 8-year-old. The other thing we heard was in America was Walter Reuther said. I just wonder, who is Walter Reuther and how do you spell that? R-E-U-T-H-E-R, it's a German-American name. He was the head of the mighty UAW, the United Auto Workers. And we today cannot imagine how great and how important the auto workers or other big unions, the AFL-CIO, was and were, since unions in the private sector have faded since then. And Reuther was a social democrat. That is, he wanted to replicate Scandinavia or Germany or maybe Yugoslavia in the United States, first within union land and then for the whole country. One of the interests, and he got out the vote. Unions were much closer to the Democratic Party than they are today, in part because we've created laws that distance unions from the party, but they were almost equivalent at that time. He wanted to get out the vote for Democrats who would support his social democratizing plans. He did. He could claim he helped to elect Johnson more than he helped to elect Kennedy more than, and therefore he was owed these things, and Johnson knew it. What's interesting about the 60s is the one thing that the unions wanted that they didn't get was an end to what we call right to work, the loophole whereby some states don't have to have the most stringent union culture, where you can start a company without unionizing and where the people who work in your shop don't have to join the union. That we call that right to work. It's a section of an old law, the Taft-Hartley Act. Well, of course, the union men, Reuther and George Meany, the leader of the AFL-CIO, said, oh my gosh, this loophole is a life threatener to us. It threatens our existence because state after state is opting to be right to work. let's close that darn loophole, just as Elizabeth Warren is suggesting today. And they almost did. They almost managed to get Johnson to do it. Johnson just ran out of steam sort of late in the game and didn't get that particular piece of legislation through. Therefore, the natural experiment of right-to-work state versus closed state, state where unions are very dominant, came to pass, and America saw that right-to-work states did grow faster and indeed drew manufacturing jobs. So we have a record in the United States of what damage an overly demanding union can do that we never would have had had the Great Society succeeded in all its aspects.
Pruitt-Igoe, a housing complex that you begin with, you know, it's early in the book and it's very late in the book. Why is Pruitt-Igoe, what's it a metaphor for?
Well, this book is about the folly of planning. This is a kind of domestic best and the brightest. They were fools, the smart guys who planned Vietnam with their spreadsheets and their slide rules and their, they were a kind of fool who failed to look at reality. Domestically, the best and the brightest existed too, men who thought they could edit lives to achieve optimal outcomes. So Pruitt-Igoe was actually started before the Great Society. It was the beginning of the Great Society in the 50s, the first area where we had this vanity, we could manage lives. It was a housing project in St. Louis. Very large, one of the largest in the nation. And we thought, well, we'll house these people and we'll move them out of their homes. Well, they live in slums, so let's move them here and they'll all be glad. And it was a rather beautiful complex, seemed so at first to the tenants, but instantly it began to have troubles. The troubles partly had to do with the absence of growth. It was imagined that St. Louis would fill these towers, imagine 22 towers of 11 stories each, because of its incredible rate of growth. Well, St. Louis began to stop growing, in part because of its heavy unionization. You could move somewhere else and make an auto part, or more importantly, a part of a rocket more cheaply. And so the housing project, by the sheer arithmetic, failed. It didn't have enough tenants who paid enough rent for it to succeed. And what's very interesting is in the Great Society, rather than acknowledging the failure, we compounded it by spending more and more on such housing projects. The idea that big was great, and you just, when you failed once, you would just add a few zeros to your old spending, and then this time you would fail. I want to mention that the architect of Pruitt-Igoe, whose name was Yamasaki, by 1965 or so was saying, it's a project I wished I never had built. What a stunning admission from an architect.
He, of course, is better known as the architect of the World Trade Center.
Oh, he's the architect of the World Trade Center. My father, who knew him, said, don't be too hard on him. He was a nice man. He was a nice man. But the project was in the international style. The international style turns its back on commerce. It turns its back on the sense of the human. It's large in scale, unfriendly. And that aspect, the international style, made the gangs proliferate. In part, nobody cared. It was a tragedy of the commons, Pruitt-Igoe. Nobody cared about it and everyone trashed it.
If, you know, it's a great way to think about your book as the domestic policy version of the best and the brightest. Patrick Moynihan comes in for, you know, a lot of abuse in this book. Talk about Daniel Patrick Moynihan and, you know, how he is kind of the patron saint of the failure of the Great Society.
This is very interesting because a lot of us are interested in Moynihan. Moynihan was kind of the wise fool. He was the jester who sees through what the king is doing at many points. And a lot of us admire him. You know, he's been compared to Edmund Burke by Greg Weiner in his work. That is, Moynihan is a man devoted to government, who's willing to admit a mistake and yet persevere. There's some beautiful humility to that. This is the man who later became a senator from New York. Mm-hmm. But Moynihan was present and complicit at the scene of many errors. In the beginning, he writes a federal architecture manifesto, which basically says, we like modern and you can build modern and you can impose modern on people. What if people don't like modern, right? No, that doesn't matter. It's our kind of our duty to be modern. And so buildings such as HUD by Marcel Breuer, very ugly building in Washington, loved by no one. Jack Kemp called it all basement, even the upper floors. were permitted in that culture. Bulldozing was permitted. So there's Moynihan kind of pushing it along by writing this memo. He also wrote the memo that gave us the modern public sector union and became President Kennedy's executive order. And they were very proud of this executive order, 10988, because it didn't give public sector unions the right to strike. So they didn't figure it had much effect. But what it did was embolden public sector unions to expand and demand more wages, double more wages, you know, a little premium because they weren't going to strike, leading to the budget busting at the federal level and even at the state level that public sector unions represent today. So he was there, and he also tried guaranteed income, which is popular now. And he tried to write a good guaranteed income program. It's a good idea. Milton Friedman thought part of it was good. Well, it's easier to give people money than to condescend to them with wrong-headed social workers. Moynihan said accurately enough that by funding social workers, we were feeding the horses to feed the sparrows, the real vulnerabilities in our culture. But what he failed to recognize is the complexity of giving a lot of people money. When you reach the income level where the money stops, there's a tremendous disincentive to work because you want to stay in that band of income low where you get the money. And you, there's a tremendous incentive not to work when you get a guaranteed income. Think of a number of 23-year-olds all of us know. A certain payment every month will may perhaps deter them from taking certain dislikable jobs. So without sounding creepy, we all see that. It's easy to coast when you get a payment. Moynihan didn't even succeed in that. He didn't even succeed in that. And he went home to Cambridge, Massachusetts. But he was wrong about a lot. I want to add that he was wrong about a lot, but he was also right about one thing, which is seeing that the breakup of the family is destructive and that the single parent family is a challenge. And he said so and was the first person I can remember ever being canceled for saying so.
Well, he did it in the context of Black families.
He did it in the context of Black families, but it was not truly only in the right. context of Black families, because Moynihan himself came from a family where the father was absent. So he knew firsthand what a struggle it is for a young man to be with just a mother. And he knew what that meant economically and the great uncertainty, that sort of a sand beneath the feet of a family that doesn't have two parents. So he, you know, he knew that illegitimacy is probably costly and bad for education. So he said all these things and he was canceled. And so I wouldn't say he's the demon or even the fool of the book, but he's the human.
What was the role of Vietnam in both the passage of Great Society programs as well as their ultimate failure?
Well, in the standard history, Vietnam was everything. I found Vietnam was surprisingly less important. Recall that when Johnson came into office, Vietnam was not Vietnam. It was this project over there, 10,000, 50,000 men. And then it grew by the end of Johnson's term, which was 68, to 400,000, 500,000 very suddenly, but at first not. The Great Society was much loved even without any Vietnam. One can say, well, what Johnson and Reuther of the UAW were afraid of was riots in the cities. They had riots. And of course, Vietnam did in part force those riots. If you're sending my son to Vietnam, I deserve adequate housing. I deserve police who don't beat me up. Yes, absolutely. But less than I thought, frankly, when I went over it. So you want to imagine a stage of actors, the domestic best and the brightest, these geniuses who think they can re-engineer society in an almost Aldous Huxley sense. And in the background, offstage, loud thunder and rumbles made by contraptions. That's the way it felt. And some of the soldiers came home. They were wounded. They were disillusioned. But that was almost into Nixon period. It took a while. One thing that Vietnam did do for the left, and the left is in the book, was they took a look at North Vietnam and they said, oh, there's socialism. I'm going to go check it out. So there's a chapter here where Tom Hayden, the progressive activist, actually goes to Hanoi looking for socialism. Says, well, you know, I kind of get it. He was completely hoodwinked by the North Vietnamese and their Soviet allies. Oh, well. But he saw he got a sense of unity. He said they had a socialism of the heart in North Vietnam, which I think many Vietnamese would disagree with, even those from North Vietnam later. But there he was, and he drew inspiration from communism.
And he saw it as you talk about how the New Left saw socialism not as a final end state, but kind of as a process, almost the way that libertarians or Hayekians will talk about markets as a discovery process. Socialism is kind of like a discovery process.
Well, I'm not sure Tom Hayden was a socialist, but he was definitely an activist. Mm-hmm. So he wanted a mass movement. How do you get that? Well, socialism, he figured out in this period, is the way, because it's great rallying cry. It sounds good, and it's never finished. Even Karl Marx himself said it was a process. That's the beauty of it. Anyone who criticizes socialism can be rebutted. Well, we're on the way. Mm. We're not really there. And he came back from Vietnam very pleased with himself because he'd found a modus operandi for protest.
How do we know the Great Society failed? And I ask that beyond dollars and cents, or I guess the quickest kind of refutation of the Great Society is that, well, you know, we declared war on poverty, and the poverty rate in America since the early 70s has basically stayed somewhere between 10 and 15%, around 12%. Ergo, it's a failure. It hasn't worked. Or it's like the war on drugs, or, you know, the war in Afghanistan. It just keeps going, but it doesn't really win or lose. But how do we tote up the costs and the benefits, especially given that things like Medicare and Medicaid, federal aid to education, all of these things are now almost completely taken for granted as part of the landscape.
How do we know it failed? One way we know is the 1970s, because our government and then our people and then most importantly markets realized we were overspending. And in order to control the resulting inflation, we had to do something terrible and brutal, which is raise interest rates to 15 or 18%. What does that mean when an interest rate goes up like that? The downside of 18% mortgage interest rates is one fewer bedrooms in your house, maybe two. You're a family, you have two children, maybe you want three bedrooms. Wow. In the 70s, with those rates, people couldn't afford houses. They couldn't afford houses in the neighborhoods they belonged in their mind. And they couldn't afford houses commensurate to the size of their family. I remember Michael Kinsley, the author, said, that his parents had said to him, "This is the nicest house we ever had, our house. Isn't America great?" And he wrote, "Little did my parents know it would be the nicest house I ever had, because we will always have to diminish our expectations now because America is getting smaller and more costly." Or if you want to borrow money to start a business, if you borrow at 5%, you do have much more money to fool around to try out two ideas than when you borrow at 15%. Oh, only one idea gets tried. So it's a cost, it's a tax on hope. It's important to remember that in this period, because we appeared to run out of energy and run out of money, the 70s, as a result of the Great Society, we thought we had to control our population. There were, right on television, more than once, there was the serious suggestion we should introduce a heavy diaper tax so that families wouldn't reproduce so much and maybe create a whole tax structure that was the opposite of a child credit. That is disincent procreation. And that was regarded as absolute common sense, a dimming of hope, of imagination, of inspiration, the 70s. But if you want to look at it from the point of view of a student now, one way we know is the student debt crisis, because we created a system whereby the government gets involved in funding student debt. That led the universities to take a pass on fiscal responsibility, on budgetary responsibility, making them very, very expensive. The reality of budgeting in universities is like healthcare, just set the price you like. And it led them to the universities to basically dissemble and lie to students, telling them they could afford all this if they got a degree that was inspired by the 60s, such as gender studies, right? How well are you going to be paid if you study gender studies? Not very well. You're going to have trouble paying off that debt, particularly if you go to a third tier university. All these creatures were supported by Great Society.
Let's talk about Ronald Reagan, because he emerges. He was governor of California from 67 to 75. He emerges as a major figure towards the end of the book. His earlier employer at the beginning of the book, General Electric, which is a great kind of metaphor, synecdoche for the type of corporation that kind of doesn't quite make it in the way that it thought it was going to through the 60s. Reagan was a spokesman for them. But as a governor, he was totally against the Great Society because he saw it as the federal government coming in and taking more and more control, spending more and more money, causing more and more problems that more local government should be doing. But then he later, in his presidency, he described saving Social Security and Medicare through a big tax hike in the late 80s. As one of the most significant actions he took as president. He talked about those things as the final act of the New Deal. He was a New Deal Democrat. This was the most heroic thing he did. How do we make sense of where we're at, kind of as a society or as a government, when things like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid are taking up about two-thirds of the federal budget, and it's going to get bigger? Reagan is on board with that. Everybody seems to be on board with that. The Great Society as a concept seems to have lost, but in budget realities, it seems to just
In Reagan's time, Reagan would not have imagined our budget today. Maybe Reagan didn't. He should have made Friedrich Hayek the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He didn't. So he imagined that he prudently contained these programs, that it was political unreality to assume you could do away with them. And you want to remember, he did constrain welfare, both at the state and the federal level. Much of the Reagan spending was defense, and he was making a common sense judgment. Not all of us agree with it, but Reagan's judgment was, let's spend a little more on defense, and it wasn't more than entitlements.
Right.
Let's spend a little more on defense and we'll win the Cold War because we're less communist than those people over there are. And as long as we're less communist and closer to freedom than Russia, we will prevail if we only stay strong. So he was in a war. He was in the Cold War and he perceived it that way. Nowadays, it's easy to say it was all inevitable. He would have won anyhow, but that was not known at the time.
What do you do with, now you flash forward, because Reagan is 30 years ago, right? So, and now we have, a budget deal that has just been signed by Republicans and Democrats. They hate each other enough where there's an impeachment process going on. But we're spending $4.5 trillion. We spend more, the most recent defense budget went up by about $100 billion over the past few years. We're spending more on welfare and on entitlements, et cetera. I guess this leads into a final question or topic of conversation. What do we need to remember most about that Great Society moment for the current moment?
That government failed. We need to remember that government failed both parties. One of the characters is Wilbur Mills. Mm-hmm.
Best known for a very early sex scandal, right?
Right, it shouldn't be because he was a politician from Arkansas. He realized in the middle of it, the spending's going to be much greater than I said. I'm concerned. Mr. President, he said when Johnson hauled him into the White House and asked him, do you know where you are, Wilbur? I.e., you're going to agree with me. He said, Mr. President, I know where I am. I'm in the wrong place. I'm in the White House. I need to get out. Sometimes we need to get out all the way from Washington. Both parties are too vainglorious, and both parties often fail. In the book, Nixon is as bad as Johnson. In some areas, as John Cogan of Hoover points out, Nixon's programs grew faster than Johnson's, his domestic programs. Again, political trade-off. Oh, I need to finish the Vietnam War. Henry and I need to do this. Therefore, Arthur needs to be a good boy, and the rest of us need to expand the food stamp program. So politicians will do that. But the positive lesson of the period is carried by three companies, GE, what became Intel, and Toyota. And what it suggests is the answer to American problems is more often the private sector than you think. And that the private sector can outgrow the public sector if you make certain key reforms. So I would argue, If you cap Social Security and did something or other with Medicare and lowered the capital gains rate, you'd probably get enough growth that we wouldn't be in trouble.
You write in the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you say, once again, many Americans rate socialism as the generous philosophy, but the results of our socialism were not generous. May this book serve as a cautionary tale of lovable people who, despite themselves, hurt those they loved. Nothing is new. It is just forgotten. What are your hopes for this book? How will you know if your book has succeeded in kind of rehearsing a history, a recent history that is almost completely, relegated to the myths of antiquity?
Well, there's no limit to what you can achieve if you don't care who gets the credit. So I, as Reagan said, yes. But I'm just part of a group of people who are looking at history in a frank, there are a lot of charts in this book, in a frank analytic way, and say, look, here are the results. Let's remember those. I'm concerned about teaching, because in high school, we don't get this material. In college, we don't get it anymore. So our children get less clarity than even we might have had, having watched some of the history and having the books to tell the history. So my hope is that the education changes, and I am sure that it won't. That change won't come from the teachers. It has to come from young people who resent being fed a monoline about how the Great Society was great, the New Deal was great, and everything else is cold, mean, and nasty, and discriminatory. After a while, young people know that that can't be the only truth. And so my interest is in seeing them have the opportunity to ask important questions.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Amity Schles, the author most recently of Great Society, A New History. Amity, thanks for talking.
Oh, thank you, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this program at reason.com/podcasts, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.